Hi, I'm Dan.
And I'm JJ.
And welcome to The Men Who Explain Miracles. Hello and welcome. This series will focus on locked room mysteries and impossible crime fiction, published during the 1930s, 40s and 50s, commonly known as the Golden Age of detective fiction. To begin this series, we are going to look at a classic locked room book, and that is Haec Talbot's Rim of the Pit, published in 1944. The late Ed Hoke, writer of a huge amount of impossible crimes, in 1981 invited 17 well-known authors and reviewers of detective fiction to rank the top impossible crime novels of all time. Haec Talbot's Rim of the Pit came in at number 2, just behind John Dixon Carr's The Hollow Man. A lot has been said about The Hollow Man, but not about Rim of the Pit, so we thought the so-called second-best locked room mystery of all time would be a good place to start.
Haec Talbot was the nom de plume of the magician and magic writer Henning Nelms, and Rim of the Pit is his second and unfortunately final novel. Both books feature the mysterious Rogan Kincaid, and in this case, Kincaid finds himself in northern New England, in a trio of cabins surrounded by snow, with a family intent on contacting a dead relative. And unsurprisingly, there are ghostly goings on, there are mysterious occurrences, and a whole host of seeming impossibilities ready to greet. So obviously, some of the people listening to this may not have read this book. We're going to avoid spoilers for these first 5 minutes or so. So someone who hasn't read this, wanted to know about it, how would you describe it to them? What would you tell them about this book?
There's so many things to like about Rim of the Pit. I think in a way it's a tour de force. There's so much happening. There's so many impossibilities. There's so many twists and turns. There's so many plot points that turn on a dime every couple of pages. But against that, which is also really interesting, is how contained the novel is, which I found really surprising. You're basically really only in two locations with some snow between them. And I think he pulls that off really well. That kind of recipe where you've got quite a large cast of characters in a small location could get very boring and annoying very quickly. Right. But he handles that really well. And the kind of claustrophobia that comes out of that is really interesting.
Yeah, that's fair.
What about yourself?
I think, for me, the main selling point is how well so many impossibilities are strung together. There are so many books that can hinge on a single locked room murder or a single miraculous disappearance,
yeah,
or something along those lines. And I think what happens here is there are so many things happening. It's a wonderful way to get a sense of whether you are kind of game for this genre, whether this is something that you actually want to be involved in, you know, whether this is something that's going to kind of capture your imagination, because there are so many, you know, so many possibilities, which we'll obviously get into later. And I just think it means that you're never bored. There is so much going on.
Yeah,
and there's always plenty to kind of capture your attention.
So what was your initial gut reaction? I know you've read this before a number of years ago, and coming back to it for a second time, what was it like for you on this reading?
It holds up really well. I think the whole appeal of the impossible crime genre is this seeing something that doesn't have an explanation, that can't have an explanation,
yeah,
and then having that explained. And I think there's an element that sometimes that can be a little disappointing, because you build up in your mind, or it's built up in the narrative, as this,
yeah, sure,
this incredible, inexplicable occurrence. What's really nice here is I really enjoyed rediscovering these solutions. And there are some solutions in particular, some elements of it, that I think I enjoyed a lot more this time around. I think the first impossibility in particular, the solution to that, is one that it's just a real elegance to it that I did not appreciate on the first reading.
Yeah, I have a very similar experience, although I haven't had years of gap between them. But I read and then read it again, which is probably the first time I've ever read a mystery sort of two times in a row. But there's something really nice about that. And I could really begin to appreciate how much he balances how many things going on without you feeling that it's too overwhelming. What about the characters? We've got quite a large cast of all different types, nations, genders, everything.
Yeah. I think I just don't think Haig Talbot can write people. I think the women are women and the men are men, and that's fundamentally it. Some of them are patsies, one of them is foreign, and really get a sense of them as people. We were discussing before we started recording this, I think Rogan Kincaid, who's nominally the hero and possibly one of the most obnoxious protagonists I've ever encountered, he's just like a rubbish version of James Bond. And the women are not well served as women. I know you have a slightly different perspective on how the women are used in the driving of the plot, but this is not a book you're coming to for character.
I guess I think that at least the women are not just there to be saved. They bring the plot forward. They have their own ideas about what's going on. They constantly bring kind of deductive qualities to it. But yes, there's a few nice hair descriptions things like that. One too many can be annoying. But as you know, it's written in the 40s. It's of its time.
Yeah.
And we've got to always see those things in context. Aside from, the characters being a little bit generic, I do like the cast, and he manages to balance it fairly well, I think, with there being quite a large cast. There are some books where there are five shouty men and I just cannot tell the difference between any of them, and they're all lawyers or something like that. Yeah. At least here there was like a real difference between everyone, I think, and that's something to the book's credit, I reckon.
Yeah, that's true.
And before we get on to spoiling this book for everyone, the impossibilities themselves. You've already talked a little bit about how you felt there were so many good impossibilities and things happening. But again, coming back to it a second time, what was it like?
It's very impressive that he's able to string so much together. I mean, just the sheer range of what you have in here. There's such an amazing range of different problems. Like I said, it isn't just a single vanishing. It isn't just a single murder that you have to try to figure out. There are so many things going on. I think they're mostly explained away extremely well. Like, most of the explanation comes at the end. There are a few things that are resolved as we go along. Most of the explanation comes at the end. And there is this info dump on you, I guess, in the final chapter. But I really like how they are strung together in this almost kind of logical chain. I think that's extremely clever.
I agree. And I think in terms of linking that with the plotting, smaller, impossible or strange mystery can hang on the end of a chapter and keep you moving forward, but then that's explained away quickly, and I think that's but not in a way where it's battered aside, where it's given a real credible explanation. Haig Talbot's kind of magic background comes into that, I think. I think he loves showing you sleight of hand, then also showing you about how it was done and the mechanics, and that's really fun, and it makes me feel like he was doing it with flair and allowing himself to really have fun with the impossibilities. So, if you are yet to read Rim of the Pit by Haig Talbot, go and get a copy. We're going to give you a chance now, if you haven't read this book, to pause this recording, and we are going to move on to full spoilers.
Here we go then, full spoilers. You have been warned from this point on. Dan, start us off. What did you think? So let's start like we've just done. Let's look at particular aspects of the plotting, the construction, particularly the cluing, which is something I'm quite eager to talk about. What did you think was good? What did you think was not so good?
Plot-wise, actually, I think the most surprising thing for me straight off is how late the first murder comes. And I only really realised it on the second reading. You've got the sort of great start, you're introduced to all the characters, the setting, and then you move to the seance, everything that happens there. But I kind of didn't realise until the second reading that there isn't a murder till, like, it's what seems like almost halfway through. And that's, I don't know how he manages to get that to work, but actually that felt like it worked still. There was enough happening with everything else that had gone on, the building up of atmosphere, for that to work. I don't know if you agree on that.
I never thought about it in terms of particularly the murder, I think, because it's not the first murder does not represent the first impossibility.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think if I was waiting that long for the impossible aspect to rear its head, I probably would have felt it a bit more. But that's a very good point. I mean, how many murders are there? It's just, well, there are two, technically, aren't there? I suppose there is so much else, because you have the manifestation of the spirit. Actually, mm-hmm. prior to that, you have everything that's going on in the seance with the being able to read the messages.
And, yeah.
You know, Rogan Kincaid getting a message from the spirit world from his fictional grandmother and things like that, which is then explained.
Mm-hmm.
And then the spirit appears, the ghost appears and vanishes, and then they go to the other cabin.
Yeah.
And Vok is confronted by Ogden with the musket. I mean, fine, we know that's a lie, but the whole thing about the fingerprints comes out, and I think there's more than enough going on. I'll be honest, I probably felt a tiny bit bored the second time around,
mm-hmm.
just as that fingerprint stuff was happening.
Okay, yeah.
But then it kicks into gear again.
Yeah, it does, and you do feel a real shift of pace when the first murder comes and then the second and everything that goes on there.
Definitely.
Yeah. One tool that I liked, and it'd be interesting to hear your opinion on this as well, that I hadn't seen elsewhere in terms of building up a plot, was how this idea of people or Ogden being possessed runs through to create suspicion among people and to move the plot around, because there are these moments where people don't believe that he's possessed and they do, and then we don't believe it as the reader, but it makes us, it's used as a tool by who says they believe, who says that they think it's true, and what does that mean? You know, are they then giving away themselves and who they are and what kind of motives they have?
Very first time I read this, I was not completely convinced that elements of it would not be explained by just going, oh yeah, and there is spiritual possession.
Okay, you know?
It was partly Ramble House, who have produced the most recent edition of this, do have an arm of their publishing which is very, let's say, proper detection.
You
know, the Rupert Penny and Norman Barrow and that kind of stuff. Yeah. But they also do have an arm of their publishing which is a bit weirdy beardy,
mm-hmm.
and there are I think partly because there are so many other little things explained, a bit of me was in the back of my mind going, well, okay, this is widely regarded as a fantastic novel, as we've already said, it's second on that list of impossibilities from 1981. But part of me was half expecting to get to the end and then go, oh no, this is actually one of our slightly weirdy beardy publications.
The
ghostly possession. That's a thing. Someone was possessed by a ghost. And I think that's a testament, I think, to how well Talbot shifts around what's going on.
Yeah.
As you say, from person to person, because there's no, I mean, Kincaid is the nominal hero, but there's no fixed point of view that you trust. There's no Gideon Fell, there's no Hercule Poirot, no one trusts Mrs. Bradley, but there's nothing. Yeah, there's no individual trust all of the time.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, because then someone dives in and says, so this must be it, or gives an alternative explanation, or says, so they must be, this spiritual thing must be true, this Wendigo must be real. That then makes you think, what's that all about?
Yeah.
What's the reason they're saying that? And I think that's a really nice tool that he could have got very wrong, but seems to have got right. Yeah,
I think the dog really helps.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, which is a classic trope, isn't it?
It is.
The scared dog.
But like, if you read Nicholas Blake's The Case of the Abominable Snowman,
I've got it up there actually on the shelf, but I haven't.
It's not a good book, but there's a bit at the beginning which is a cat behaves in an odd way, and the explanation that you get for this, when the explanation comes, I have no idea how much that holds up. You're very welcome to try and find out if you want, once you know what the explanation is.
Yeah.
But I think the whole obscure behavior as an animal sometimes can be used as a trope and explained badly. I actually think he uses the dog really well and explains it, I think, really well. Like the whole thing about running ahead because he's fleeing from the Wendigo, and they're like, if you run, well, a dog just runs. So if you run, the dog will run, and of course the dog will be ahead of you because it's a faster runner than you. I think that's actually quite beautifully
worked. Something sweet about that.
Yeah, it really is. Are there any aspects of the cluing or the plotting where you think he doesn't get it right then? Mm-hmm. Are there aspects? I think we agree it's strung together on the whole incredibly well. There's got to be bits that aren't brilliant.
I think a lot of it seems to... The difficulties come in the final chapter with the kind of information dump, as you were saying. We get a lot of things where we get the explanations, but I didn't see how I could have seen that in the first place anyway. Or I would have appreciated the moment in which I could have seen that. One thing, yeah, that I think didn't work was the switching of the cards where the fingerprints are concerned, which I thought would be like a lovely resolution in a short story, for example. But I didn't feel like I had the opportunity to place Vok there at the time where that could have happened.
I'm intrigued how Vok got his own fingerprints on a different card and then got his fingerprints clean.
Yeah.
Like his actual fingers
clean
of whatever ink he used.
Yeah, and where is the moment that occurs, you know? Because there's loads of potential there, but I just feel like he's not using it where he's using other stuff and really playing up to it. So why not play up to that as well?
Also, as far as we're aware, the only ink they have is the waterproof pen that becomes incredibly important later on with the suicide note.
Yeah, yeah.
So if the pen is waterproof and that's the ink that he's used for his fingers, he couldn't have washed it off because it's waterproof ink. I mean, it's nitpicking.
We're into the details
yeah,
now.
It's nitpicking, but it is just there are just the little things like that. The suicide note is another one where obviously it has to have been written before because they didn't have... She didn't have any other pen. Really? You know?
Yeah.
Did she not have any other pen?
Yeah. The fact she's got a bureau in her room sort of suggests she's got another pen. Let's hope. Yeah. Although the idea of that bit, she uses the pen beforehand for a long period of time so that when she uses it at the seance, it's not seen as strange.
Very clever.
That is it. That's clever. So why not play up to that every time?
Yeah,
you know, like with the fingerprints. Why not show us the moment, the sleight of hand moment? So he's got those great magic-rooted ideas, the sleight of hand, which are so lovely, but he doesn't always use them, I think.
That's fair. That's fair. So I guess we discussed the characters very briefly in the non-spoiler section.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's so many aspects of character. I think motivation and kind of like the motive for the crimes and the particular actions, the fact that we know Vok is behind all of the impossibilities and his reasons for that and his reasoning for that.
Yeah.
I mean, pick something and dive in, by all means. I'd ask you a specific question, but there's so much. Start wherever you want to start.
I think we've established that Talbot wasn't the best character writer and everything... There are some sort of pastiches and there's some sort of almost parody-like characters, but I'll start with something that I thought worked and then something that I think didn't work. I actually quite liked Jeff as a character. Something about his constant desire to always say, well, it must be this then, to take kind of evidence at face value. And it's a little bit like in Poison Chocolate's case where we get that satire of the detective or the detective writer saying this is what's true and you're just expected to believe it. It seems like Talbot was slightly above that. He knew that. And Jeff is a nice character who sort of represents for me like someone who just says, a writer who just says, and this is what happened, so that's what makes it true. And so I like the way that Jeff is always running at a solution and then it's being broken down.
Jeff is... a good name for a dependable young man in a piece of GAD writing. I mean, Carr had at least a couple of Jeffs.
Yeah, sure.
Carr Dixon, because there's Jeff Marl, isn't there, in Play Court Murders? I want to say Unicorn Murders.
Is there a Jeff in She Died a Lady as well?
Oh, possibly.
But
I think they could all just be called Jeff.
Good, solid young men who run at the truth they think they know.
Exactly. And they're always after one of the women as well.
There's always
a Jeff who's chasing her.
Yeah. Maybe one that I didn't think worked, and I know you've got some thoughts on this, is Vok. Vok's motivation for all that he does, I think, is a real sticking point that can leave you at the end of this novel thinking, really? Really? Particularly when we get to the final chapter and it's all revealed in that moment of the train carriage where Kincaid and Vok sit together. And Vok has very little to suddenly change him into like a ruthless punisher, in which he will then spirit up a huge amount of impossibilities to punish Ogden for what seems like very little reason.
It is like he just suddenly, because he discovers that he has a hand free in the sails.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not convinced that getting your hand free in a ring of people is as easy as novelists make out. So I just don't think it could be done.
Yeah, sure.
I think you'd notice.
Yeah.
Because Ogden recognises the moccasin and can obviously therefore touch the moccasin.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a very specific word to use.
Yes,
obviously,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
Fine, I totally get that he appreciates that he's touched the moccasin. But from there, everything that Vok does is very focused on bringing Ogden down.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I think that's very scant evidence. And there is that astonishing convenience at the end as well. Well, there's actually nothing that suggests that Ogden is responsible for Irene's murder.
Yes.
And he goes, oh, you know what? Yeah, I'm a deeply horrible man. And Kincaid is like, oh, no, actually, because, look, I discovered this thing, so you're entirely vindicated.
Yeah.
And you're like, that's alarmingly convenient. Alarming that Vok wasn't even aware of that and was just so happy to storm ahead and just completely, you know, make this guy convinced, even before the murder, that he was possessed and he was flying and snatching guns off the walls and things like that.
And it's like with a pen, I mean, he could have been carrying a suicide note in his pocket because he forgot it was in his pocket. I mean, why is it suddenly his vindication, you know? So this shows that it obviously was all tied up for you and that he was going to kill his wife anyway, so it's all fine.
Yeah.
And it's annoying because the kind of psychology of being driven to create impossibilities to protect himself and drive someone else to certain actions is actually a really interesting idea and could have been carried out much better than that.
Yeah.
But in the resolution, it just feels so thin, so frail. You know, you could have got so much more out of that, I think.
I think we learn enough about Vok and his backstory, and it's done quite sparingly, that at least semi-justifies that kind of savagery, that almost kind of that savage response on his personal level, if you like. Because they talk about his being a refugee, his having been chased out by the Gestapo.
Yeah.
And there is that aspect of he could come from this very life and death struggle form of existence, and so he's going to have quite extreme reactions to these situations.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But as you say, I think there's something which is far more interesting that could be made out of it, and I think that's very, very quietly implicit, rather than something which is very explicitly discussed. Like, oh, well, because of Vok's experience being hounded across Europe for 5 years, etc., etc.
Yeah.
I think it is just like, oh, God, actually, no, I'm an awful person. Oh, no, you're fine. You know.
And actually, here's a job that you should apply for.
Oh, that's right, yes.
As a magician and get your life back on track.
Yeah,
kind of
that's
thing.
A good point. That's a good point.
It becomes a little bit of a parody then, and a bit like, Talbot's falling into some traps of character here where he's making us feel like there's a nice resolution at the end when actually is that justified?
It's that it's
emotionally,
that, it's,
psychologically.
It's sort of like equivalent of like bad 80s sitcoms. Everyone sits around the house, a good old chuckle at the end and everything's fine.
Yeah,
a little bit. Kincaid is the only other character who really emerges at all.
Yeah.
Everybody else is a little bit to type, I think. Ambler is, I guess, moderately rounded, but mainly just because he's a slightly old man who's a bit rational.
Yeah.
Is there anything to say about Kincaid?
I was always confused by him, and it'd be interesting for those listeners out there who know a bit more about the pulp genre. It felt to me, and not having read much pulp stuff, but that he was a little bit like a pulp character at the start. You know, big muscles, there to kind of attract the ladies. And then suddenly he's cerebral, and then he's not cerebral, he's kind of distant, and then so I just didn't know where I was with him most of the time. And then I thought that Talbot was doing a really clever thing when Kincaid says, actually no, at the end it is all true, he can fly, it was a real Ogden was really possessed. And I thought, oh great, we're getting into Kincaid here being able to kind of twist the plot or something like that, or create false belief so that he can then change something later, but it's never referred back to. And there was just this constant kind of like, I can see he's sort of quiet and in the distance and that kind of cool guy, but then also it's impenetrable because he keeps mixing his character around.
The solutions are very intuitive. There's no cluing. It's not, I don't think this is a novel of detection.
Yeah, sure.
I think there are There are hints of what's going on, but as I said before, there's no real character to have a point of view from, and there's no real detective character. And, you know, they discuss various permutations and combinations of events, and some of them inevitably turn out to be the correct solutions. But there's never a point where, I mean, there's the whole thing about him wearing the ski boots, so therefore he could have worn the other boots. But that's, as far as, like, in terms of proper deductive reasoning, I don't think there's really much else.
Yeah.
And I mean, to an extent, Talbot kind of admits this, because in the final chapter, Kincaid can explain a certain amount and then Vok has to fill in the rest. But the fact that Kincaid is even able to explain as much as he is seems a little author insert to me.
And to be able to explain that without us really knowing how or when he came to that moment, like we would with Fel, you know, or someone like that, we'd get these lovely moments of kind of back and forth.
Yeah,
I'd be interested to know from what you think from your point of view, what would have had to have changed about Kincaid to make this a novel of detection, like you say, or give him a feel of a detective, maybe not necessarily a police detective or something, but what did he need? What was he missing?
I find it very interesting that throughout the text, Talbot refers to him as the gambler. There's that story told where, you know, he's walked into the casino and the guy sat down playing cards and he's like, oh, I'm not going to play with someone who cheats or something like that, whatever he calls him. And he reaches into his vest and reaches into the other guy's vest and pulls out a couple of cards. I'm like, oh, he'd always be physically prepared for any action. And you're just like, okay, fine. But then he sold, and there are references to things like, you know, he'd stayed alive by paying attention to his surroundings. But it's never filled out more than that. You're told that he will be prepared. You're told that he pays attention to his surroundings. It's never really demonstrated him doing either of those two things.
And I
find it very telling that he is the gambler on quite a regular basis throughout. And he's never... There is that very faux cerebral air, I think, which is like it has to fall on someone's shoulders.
Yeah.
And Vok is responsible for most of what happens, so it can't be Vok. So kind of almost by a process of elimination, and the fact that Kincaid was in the previous book, it has to be him.
Yeah.
So a lot would have to change.
Yeah, for sure.
I think that's probably a separate recording in it on its own.
I guess it's that, again, another trap where you try to write a distant, cool character who is then also having to explain everything, which is sort of a little bit of as the time got to me there, it's not going to work, is it?
That's fair.
And maybe, I don't know, Talbot tripped himself up with making Kincaid who he was.
Perhaps. I guess finally then we should probably move on. The various impossibilities. There are approximately 8,000 of them.
Yes, absolutely.
We need to look at some of them.
Yeah.
Do you have, what's a quick word on this, do you have a favourite and a least favourite?
I don't know if I can pick one favourite, but for me, I preferred the smaller mysteries, the smaller impossibilities here. There's something about them that grabbed me. Maybe I'll speak more generally first. I think Talbot, being a magician in his kind of other life, falls into the idea that the solutions are much more magic-y type of solutions to the bigger crimes, less so to the smaller ones, or maybe similar with the smaller ones, but they feel more elegant. Sometimes I feel like, for example, having a kite strapped to your back and running away from it is like, okay, I can see it works, you know, and maybe it would work, but it's like a... When you're in a real mechanical, classic disappearance of like an elephant, say, in a magic show, and then it's surrounded by people, but the elephant disappears, then you find out that actually all those people are in on it, and there's a bit of set that moves. It's disappointing in some sense, but it's more about the illusion at the start. But the it's disappointing because it's so mechanical and it's so just getting the job done.
Yeah.
I think what makes a great impossibility on a grand scale, where you see that in Carr, in Sladek's writing, in The Best of Jonathan Creek, is where there's just a moment where there's a simplicity and elegance to the solution that just is like, oh, I was looking there, but it was happening there. And it's so beautiful. And I think Talbot does that. It's like, you're looking here, but here was the 40 things that made that happen, because it's like a magic trick, like a convoluted magic trick. And I think he expects us to think that that's okay or that's cool because you're seeing something mechanical. But so that was disappointing to me, I think. And that happened in the kite is a big one. The footprints, for sure. I mean, it got so complicated at some point where you're saying, and then he arced round to the left and then to the right. And then who has walked where at what point? It's got so complicated. But things like, although we've had a little bit of a laugh about having a second pen, the idea that of that being an older piece of writing, I think is that's really nice and simple. Or something like, for me, actually, here's my favourite one, was Vok crawling along the snow to eliminate his own footprint. I think if that had been a solution to a short no footprints mystery, I think that would be really beautiful. And some of those things had a moment of flair that I really, really enjoyed. What about for you?
I think my favourite is probably the appearance and specifically the disappearance of the ghost at the seance. I just love this idea of Vok going down the corridor, into the bathroom, using the door to get through into Ogden's room, and then when everyone's run to the bathroom door and is trying to break it down, he just nips across behind them.
It's lovely.
I mean, the map on the back cover is beautiful for helping you appreciate it.
Yeah.
And I just love it. He just nips in, he peels off the mask, he peels off the gloves, and he steps out with the lamp, and you just... And then he's the first person into the bathroom to investigate the bolt on the door.
Yeah.
I mean, thank heaven whoever invented just the slidable bolt to seal a door is responsible for a significant majority of all that's brilliant about classic detective fiction. I think that is just fabulous.
Yeah.
And there's a real simplicity to that just appeals to me. I think possibly my least favourite is the shooting of Ogden by Ador, the guide, and the way the bullet is taken out of him at the end.
Yeah.
Where he wasn't shot, he was stabbed when he and Vok have the fight.
Yeah.
And Vok stabs him with the knife because he's holding the knife in an overhand grip. And you go, well, a knife wound does not look like a bullet wound.
Yes.
And
that's a good point.
I know that's people are not gonna necessarily appreciate that if they don't have any experience of it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think I would like to think if someone was... we don't know how Kincaid gets the bullet into the body, but I can allow for the fact that there's some legerdemain going on there.
Yeah, fine. Sure. Yeah.
Prestidigitation.
Not
legerdemain. I can appreciate there's something going on there, fine. But the idea that whoever it is, I can't remember who it is, who takes the bullet out, doesn't really look like a bullet wound.
Yeah, sure.
Is a bit... You know, I mean, I'm being very picky there, I think, because the way it's strung together is very clever. And it is, you know, four or five times the impossibilities that you get in a lot of impossible crime novels.
Sure.
But there's that bit of me that's just like, you are forcing a card on us here.
Mm-mm.
You're forcing a card on us here to make this happen.
I'm not sure if you are being picky, because actually it's the main part of the reveal in the train carriage where he says he was stabbed, or who stabbed him? You did. That is a big moment, and it could be a real gasping moment. And the first time I read it, I was like, oh, that's surprising. It's a mystery where you find someone dead in a locked room, but they've been drowned. You know, when you have the moment of sudden switch, the weirdness of... And I was like, oh, great, that's interesting. But then how it happened was a little bit disappointing.
Yeah, that's fine.
And so, like you said, if it's going to be the big moment where it's a stab wound rather than the gunshot, he did so well with so many others. Why didn't he come up with another way to cover that up? Or, you know, there was a stabbing at some other point and he could have used a wound or something like that. How about work that out somehow, you know? Why didn't he just shoot him earlier? I don't know. I guess it was accidental, though, wasn't it? But yeah, who knows?
I mean, I mean, there is that very famous book where someone who has been shot, or someone who's been stabbed, turns out to have been shot.
Yeah.
And here we've got someone who is shot, turns out to have been stabbed.
Yeah, sure.
And it is. I personally think the other one does it so much better.
Yeah.
I think the reversal of it is much cleverer there.
Yeah.
I think the reversal of it is much more intelligent.
Yes, it's true. It's true. Yeah. We could talk about this forever and ever, and it's a great book. But let's round up with... We've obviously taken this from the original 1981 list of the top locked room mysteries. Do you think it deserves its place as second place?
I do. I do think it deserves its place as second place. I do not think The Hollow Man in first place deserves its place as first place. I think that is...
Another podcast coming.
Exactly. That is the issue with me. I do think there's so much that this does so well. And I think, you know, all of the problems that we highlight are, I think it's fair to say, done in the spirit of adventure. You know, we're not looking to tear this down ridiculously. But I do think this is easily one of the five best impossible crime novels ever written, and probably that ever will be written. Anyone paying attention to my blog or any of the stuff I've done will know what I think should be in first place.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to hazard a guess?
Is it The Green Capture?
It is The Green Capture, it is, which is the single finest detective novel ever written.
A great book if you haven't read it. Get on with it.
Problem of the Green Capsule, or The Black Spectacles, as it is also known by John Dixon Carr, is just a phenomenally brilliant book. I think behind that, I'm happy with this being the second best. But like I say, that will change tomorrow. But yeah, it's definitely top five. What about you?
In the spirit of maybe nitpicking and trying to get really into this book, we could pull out a lot that is maybe not working. But the sheer amount of things that Talbot balances and gives us is just, gosh, compared to so many other crime novels and locked room mystery novels in particular, I mean, it's just amazing what he's balancing. Yeah, so I think it, if maybe not second place, it definitely should be in everyone's top selection on their bookshelf of locked room mysteries, absolutely.
Final question. Why is it called Rim of the Pit?
I think that's actually a really clever title. And I think a few times it comes up where it's the gap between the human world and the spirit world. And I think, I can't remember who it is, at some point says it's like we're standing on the edge of the pit or the edge of the abyss.
Do they?
Yeah, and that comes up a few times. It's like I'm on the edge.
Does it?
Yeah, God. Yeah. And that really stuck out to me as quite a clever title. And I feel the rim of the pit is the place where all these wraiths, these demons, these, and in a way, the skeletons in the closet, which is almost what the whole book's about, isn't it? The kind of the past sins coming to the fore and being dealt with, which I guess is clear in the opening line of come here to make a dead man change his mind. It's about bringing those the dead things up from the pit. That's
nice. Is that
that's what I think. Yeah.
So what's the line from The Tempest? Hell is empty and all the devils are here.
Yeah.
I do not remember the word pit or the idea of an edge of a pit being mentioned at all. I must apologise to our listeners. I have no recall of that at all.
I will dig it out and find out what page it was
please
on
do.
And yeah. post about it.
Please do.
Yeah.
Please do.
Thank you so much for listening. I've been Dan, and I blog at WordPress under The Reader is Warned.
I, once again, have been JJ, and I also blog at WordPress at The Invisible Event.
There's going to be plenty of opportunity for discussion on the blog, so please come on over and see you next time.
Bye-bye.